Don't ask us to predict. Do not ask us to predict.
Hello and welcome to the 538 Politics Podcast. I'm Galen Druk, and this is a special Brexit update. British Parliament spent the week voting on a whole bunch of measures, beginning with a rejection of Prime Minister Theresa May's slightly revised Brexit agreement and ending with the approval of an extension of the deadline for leaving the European Union. That deadline is currently March 29th, which of course is just 2 weeks away. And joining me to break down the complex political questions facing the United Kingdom are the hosts of the Talking Politics podcast, David Runciman and Helen Thompson. They're both professors at the University of Cambridge, and they first joined me back in December when May's original agreement failed. So Helen Thompson is a professor of political economy. Hello, Helen. Welcome to the show.
Hello, Galen.
And David Runciman is a professor of politics. Hi, David. Also, welcome to the show.
Hi. Hi.
And listeners, if you are curious about the day-to-day of Brexit, their Talking Politics podcast is a fantastic place to get your fix. All right, I know we're 538 and we're a data-driven organization, but if you can just indulge us for a moment and give us a sense of how Brits are reacting to the week's events, like where's the national mindset right now?
So I'm not sure we represent the national mindset. It really does depend which Brits. But I mean, Helen will have a view on this, which may be different from mine. So there's no question there is a mix of exasperation and bafflement. And again, from what one can see, both from polling, but also from anecdotal evidence, there's this weird mismatch in that most people have somehow internalized the thought that what Theresa May is trying to do is a really botched job and this is a bad deal and it doesn't poll well. And yet there seems to be still a groundswell of people who want to get it done. And given the only way to get it done as things stand is to embrace her deal, I think it's also fair to say that people are pretty conflicted.
Yeah, I think the only thing I would add to that is there does seem to be some evidence this week that amongst Conservative voters and amongst Conservative members, the new version of the withdrawal agreement seems to be better supported than the previous one was. Now, that may be coming out of this feeling of exasperation of just wanting the whole thing over. But I think the idea that Conservative voters, from the point of view of the Parliamentary Conservative Party, are deeply opposed to this, or a majority of them are, doesn't really hold any longer.
I know that currently the Prime Minister is trying to get support for a third vote on her agreement. Does that mean that it could possibly pass next week, that feeling of exasperation amongst Conservatives?
I mean, I think it definitely could. Apart from anything else, in this process, you shouldn't rule anything out. But it definitely could. And something did change last night, I think. And Helen and I have been talking about this a lot. We talk about it a lot on Talking Politics, that for months, including when we last spoke to you, Galen, we've been in this situation where the people who, for different reasons, are opposing what the government is trying to do had reasons to think that their option was still on the table. And the forcing of the choice had never happened. People could, in a sense, delay and hope that next time round, the thing that they wanted would rise to prominence. We're very close, and I think Tuesday will be the day where a lot of that thinking will be exposed as wishful. And we're getting closer to the only thing that was ever going to move this on, which is where it becomes a binary choice. There have been way too many options on the table. And it looks like on Tuesday that it can at least be framed as a choice between two versions of delay, one of which is her deal is passed, she goes to the EU, they give her a technical extension, and we leave on the terms of this withdrawal agreement. The other of which, however you dress it up, is at least a stalling and possibly a complete stymieing of Brexit. So the choice is getting close. It's not there yet, but it's getting close to being Theresa May's deal or no Brexit. And that choice changes the dynamics.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think the only thing really that the group in the Conservative Party of MPs who've thus far been unwilling to back the withdrawal agreement have still got to hope to hold on to as a hope would be the idea that the European Union would not agree any extension whatsoever. And then that the March 29th legislation still matters. If they could persuade, or not even if they could persuade, but if one EU member state were to veto the application for an extension, then we would be back with the March 29th deadline. Now, I think at that point, though, that the people then who would have to reverse gears are the people who are still hoping to stop Brexit, because then you still have got a forced choice. You just haven't got it quite the way that Theresa May was initially hoping to frame it.
So let's talk about this extension vote. It sounds like we don't actually know what the specifics of it are yet. It will depend on what happens between now and next week and then what the European Council decides. So what is the dynamic going on there?
So and again, Helen might, we're in the situation now where we might both think that we know, and then it turns out we think it's something different.
But believe me, having covered US politics for the past 3 years, I know the feeling.
You know where we're coming from. So my understanding of what happened in the House of Commons last night was that the amendment that was overwhelmingly passed by a majority of around 200 presents a kind of choice, which is between a known extension and a completely unknown extension. So the known, if you want clarity, you have to vote for Theresa May's deal, because what you get is the deal is passed. She asks for an extension till the end of June to allow for the technical legislative business of British politics to catch up, because you can't do it, probably. You can't do it in the deadline of the 29th of March. But in a sense, people know where they are with that. The way it was framed, I think, was explicitly designed to make the other option sound almost unknowable. And it has baked into it a thing that causes genuine terror among the many MPs, which is, if you want a longer extension, that takes us past the European parliamentary elections, and we will have to field candidates, which is a kind of nightmare scenario. So the options are a known extension for a fixed date and an unknown extension for an unknown reason that take you past the European parliamentary elections. And that is meant to terrify MPs into voting for May's deal. Now, it may work, it may not work, but she's at least actually finally got them where she wants them.
As well, and I would add to that, it would seem that the European Union has effectively already allocated those parliamentary seats that would be the British seats. So actually, the EU would be confronted, I think, with a real, real difficulty just in these logistical, if you like, technical grounds and allowing Britain to participate in the European Parliament. So you'd have to gamble that actually that the European Union would be willing to set that problem entirely aside in order to get to the longer extension.
And I definitely don't want to make it sound like that Theresa May had some brilliant, deep scheme and all of these seeming defeats were leading her to this point. I think it's been catastrophic for her, and I think among the challenges she faces before next Tuesday is that she's still trying to sell something which has been so roundly trashed by everyone that it's, you know, it's going to be very hard for many people to swallow. But she's got it where she wants it, partly because she's framed it as a choice between two options, one of which is going to be very unpalatable for lots of people, including some Labour MPs. But as Helen says, she hasn't completely taken no deal off the table, because there is always still that underlying risk, if people miscalculate, with this sort of open-ended extension, no one knows what for, that the EU says no. And if the EU says no, then we leave on the 29th of March. So weirdly, I'm still absolutely not sure if she's going to succeed. But she has somehow got to a point where it's lined up in the most favourable way it could. But to get there, she's destroyed her reputation, possibly her party and her career.
I think the other thing that was really significant that happened last night was that there was going to be an amendment which effectively would have stopped her bringing the third meaningful vote next week, or at least it could have stopped her with the help of the Speaker. And the person who was pushing that amendment, the Labour MP who was, pulled the amendment quite late on. So actually, I think that the combination of the fact that she did not lose control of the parliamentary timetable, it's true she only hung on that vote by two votes, and the fact that she wasn't impeded from bringing a meaningful vote next week were really significant victories for her.
Yeah, so last night was Theresa May's best day in a long time, but to say that doesn't say much, because she hasn't had many.
But wasn't this always going to happen? Wasn't this deadline always there? And if she could just push the debate right up until the deadline, she could use it as a tool to finally get people to vote for her agreement?
Yeah, I mean, and though I say it's kind of lined up in a way that she wants, it's not her preferred choice. So her preference was always to confront people with her deal or no deal, because she thought people, you know, there's a clear, big majority of members of the House of Commons who are terrified of no deal. In the end, it was always going to come out to a choice, but it's come out as her deal or no Brexit, with the no deal somehow in the background. But even though people have been saying for a long time she's running down the clock and she's trying to get to this point where she can force the issue, to get to this point, she's had to survive so many near-death experiences. It could have been derailed in so many ways. It still could be derailed in so many ways. There's nothing inevitable about this. And right. even between now and Tuesday, I mean, apart from anything else, you know, this still turns on what the Attorney General says. He has to dress up his last week's legal advice in a new framing so that people can, you know, swallow their pride and accept this thing that they've said is unacceptable. So nothing about this, you know, with these deep forces that are pointing it one way, nothing about this is predetermined.
I think what's really interesting is that, in some sense, the gravitational force is on her side. It always has been, because the passage of the withdrawal bill and the political declaration is the least wishful position that there is at the moment by some distance. And you have a lot of MPs on both sides who are engaging in what are essentially wishful positions for which they are hard to find a practical basis for, and they don't have a parliamentary majority for. So in that sense is that because the gravitational force was always on her side, she did, as you say, Galen, in some sense need to get to this point, to the hardening of the choices, and then she'd got the opportunity. And this is why I think that she does have a reasonable chance of winning a vote. Now, it might not even be on the third meaningful vote. We might be into talking about a fourth meaningful vote. But the paradox is that she is a very weak parliamentary leader of her party, probably least as much so with Jeremy Corbyn as any other leader of a parliamentary party in a very long time in British politics. And in that sense, I think that the best card in some sense she has left to play, and this is a personal one, is essentially to offer herself as a sacrifice, say, you vote for this withdrawal agreement and the political declaration, and then I will be gone.
And so what does that coalition look like that could get Theresa May's agreement passed? I mean, would they need the support of Labour? Could they find it elsewhere?
Yeah, they would. So it has certain necessary elements. So the DUP, the Northern Irish Party, who keep Theresa May in power, give her a majority in the Commons, will have to agree to this. And there are indications that they are moving that way. Who knows? But I don't think it can happen without them, not least because many of the more hardline Brexiteers in the Conservative Party have said they will follow the DUP's lead. So that has to happen. There seem to be a hard core of, again, the numbers are so hard to say, but maybe 20, 25 Conservative MPs who will not vote for this deal, even with a gun to their heads. Therefore, it will need some Labour MPs to support it.
I think in the US, we would call that the Freedom Caucus.
Right. there are quite a lot of Labour MPs. Certainly, I mean, you know, again, the deep irony here is that in their heart of hearts, I think most MPs regret Brexit. But almost all of them were elected on manifestos committed to honouring the referendum. And some of them take that more seriously than others. But quite a lot of Labour MPs take that seriously. And even last night, you saw quite significant numbers voting against the second referendum, explicitly on the grounds that they were elected to Parliament to honour the referendum, and they cannot go back to their constituencies and claim to support a second time round. So those people have to be given a reason. And I think the main reason that has to be given to them to pass Theresa May's withdrawal agreement is that it might pass. So until this point, none of them have been given a reason to take this huge risk with their reputation within the party by effectively allowing Brexit to happen. If the deal was going to go down, it's a useless sacrifice. It may be, it may not. A lot depends what happens this weekend, but it may be that some of them start to sense that it could get over the line with their help, at which point we'll see.
And is Labour still positioning itself to try to get a longer extension and maybe push this to the end of 2020? Like, is that the general sense, apart from these maybe a few MPs who would vote for Theresa May's deal?
I don't think that the Labour leadership actually has a clear position on Brexit itself. I think the Labour leadership's position all the way along has been that they want to use Brexit in order to get a general election. And I think that, in some sense, the fortunes have turned against them on this score, and that they're back to the position, or the Labour leadership is back to the position of having the hard choices coming to it, though it's pretty difficult to see how it's ever going to actually vote this withdrawal agreement through the House of Commons. But I think what you could see that might have led them to be optimistic about that earlier in the week was it looked like the Conservative Party's parliamentary party's whipping operation in the House of Commons had broken down and caused huge fury amongst backbenchers, that members of the cabinet had been allowed effectively to break a three-line whip The whipping operation on the Conservative side looked more effective again, significantly more effective again last night. And that means the opportunities for Labour to think that they can peel off some Conservative MPs in a no-confidence motion, I think, have significantly diminished. But I think it's really hard to think about what actually, in terms of Brexit itself, the Labour leadership is trying to achieve.
And just to give you a sense of the breakdown of discipline in the Conservative Party, the most extraordinary thing of all that happened this week probably happened last night, because Theresa May's lost her voice. The Brexit minister had to sum up the debate, advocating that people pass the government's motion looking for this extension on Theresa May's terms. So he finished the debate asking people to vote that way, and then he himself personally voted the other way 20 minutes later.
But it was a free vote.
It was a free vote, but it's still, if you are, I would say, a member of the public looking at this, you would have good reason to be baffled.
Yeah.
And to think that maybe the Conservative Party isn't entirely clear what it's doing, and yet, as we know in politics, sometimes the party that doesn't know what it's doing wins.
Fair enough. As you mentioned, an important piece of all of this is whatever the European Council decides. Do we know their positioning right now? Is there any reason, say this agreement were to pass next week, is there any reason that the European Council wouldn't grant a 3-month extension in order to pass whatever else is necessary in order to get the withdrawal?
It's pretty difficult to see any circumstances in which the European Council would say no if the withdrawal agreement were to pass or about to pass, and the technical things that David was talking about earlier in terms of other legislation were needed. I think beyond that, it's quite difficult to judge. I think that there isn't actually any agreement amongst the EU 27 about what kind of extension, or if any extension at all, in substantive terms, should be offered to the British government. So if you listen to what the Irish government got to say, then clearly they'd be happy with an extension that sort of went on almost like, I guess, indefinitely until Brexit would just go away. But that's clearly not the position of the French government. It's clearly not the position of the Spanish government. Then there's a question about whether the Italian government would try to, if you like, prove its Eurosceptic credentials by being standing up to the rest of the European Union and saying we're not prepared to play ball with you about the way in which you're engaging with the Brexit question. So I think that the basic consensus that has existed amongst the EU 27 about how to deal with Brexit, that consensus doesn't exist any longer when it comes to the matter of the extension.
And I think this is part of what feeds into that thought that the choice on Tuesday could be between something that's known and something that's really unknown, because the extension requested for the specific technical reason, it's very hard to see, as Helen says, Europe, let's call it that, turning it down. But the other one, the route to an extension of unknown length for unknown reason, opens up the whole can of worms of current European politics. Not least, we have to remember, there's not just the terror of having to fight European elections in Britain where we thought we would never have to do that again, but there are European elections coming up in all of these countries, and in some of them there are real anxieties about the kinds of people who might do well. They are all of these politicians have their national electorates to consider. So the open-ended possible fork in the road that comes out from Tuesday leads you straight into the nest of European politics. It's another reason why, if it's skillfully handled, that can be presented as something that even some of the hardline Brexiteers would really want to avoid.
And particularly because if you then bear in mind that some of these EU governments might say, OK, yes, but a number of conditions will have to be attached to that, and that they would be very tough, and that those conditions may be ones that a majority in Parliament find entirely unacceptable.
So we spoke last December, and we talked a little bit about the divisions in British politics that Brexit had brought to the fore. We mentioned then that public opinion had shifted slightly towards Remain, not overwhelmingly so. You mentioned at the top that people felt conflicted, essentially, that they want this all to be over, but also Theresa May's agreement is deeply unpopular. Since December, have the dynamics of Brexit changed at all?
So, again, we might have different views on this. My sense of it is on the Remain-Leave question, not a lot. Maybe again, there's a very, very slow drift among some people who were sort of, as it were, in the middle to doubt that Brexit is a good idea. But it's not something that you can pick up in a way and point to as there's been a shift in public opinion. I would say if there has been a shift, it's been the hardening of a view on the Brexit side in favour of no deal. So one of the odd things that has come out is that when people are polled, there's quite strong support among Brexiteers in the public for just just leave. Screw them. Let's just get it done. I mean, not just let's get it done because we can't bear to think about it for another minute. It's just like we voted for this thing and we want it to happen. And we knew what we were voting for, which is one of the complications around the thought of a second referendum. Because at the moment, okay, maybe in polling, Remain might be at some polls 54 and Leave 46. But named options, May's deal, some version of no Brexit or some softer Brexit, and no deal, on some of those polls, no deal is the most popular. So could you have a referendum that didn't at least offer people no deal? And one of the options that's being floated at the moment is Theresa May's deal passes and then it comes with the caveat, not only does she quit at some point soon, but that then the people are given another choice between her deal and Remain. And many MPs are deeply uncomfortable with that because they say it's possible among named options that no deal is currently the most popular and it won't be on the ballot paper. This is part of the nightmare.
Yeah, I think that the views of the no deal versus Theresa May's withdrawal agreement actually fluctuate quite a bit. And I do think that this week, at least in the latter part of the week, there's some evidence that actually polling for the withdrawal agreement has significantly improved. And as I say, I think particularly amongst Conservative voters and potentially amongst Conservative members, I think that...
Of whom it should be said, there are not very many. Yeah. The Conservative Party membership, no one knows, but it's probably about 100,000.
But they are a constraint. Those Conservative Party members are a constraint on what their MPs' positions can be. Mm-hmm. And I think that it's pretty clear that when the withdrawal agreement was first published, there was a very strong pressure to say, look, we're not in favour of this, and you know there'd be threats of possible threats of deselection as a candidate. So if there is some softening of opinion amongst Conservative members, that does actually open up some possibilities. I don't think that the fluctuations between Remain and Leave are really, as David says, that different than where they were in December. I think that in some sense, perhaps the dominant feeling, even amongst those who don't actually like the idea of leaving the European Union, of just get this thing done. And in some sense, the form of it is ceasing in some sense to matter.
And again, what you said, what we talked about last time, I'll give you a much shorter answer to this, is the question, have any of the deep divisions that were revealed by the Brexit referendum been bridged over this period? No.
I guess that's not particularly surprising.
No, but at least it's an answer that I can do in one word.
Yes, there you go. I want to get into a little bit of the political science behind this all, reflecting a little bit on the past almost 3 years. What has this process taught you as political scientists about the British political system with regards to any shortcomings or challenges that it may have going forward?
It's definitely been interesting. We're in this weird phase at the moment where two things seem to be happening. The normal rules of British parliamentary government, particularly what you might call accountability, seem to have been suspended. Theresa May is losing these overwhelming votes on the central, in some sense, the only plank of the government's policy platform, which would traditionally have precipitated the fall of the government, and the government just stumbles on from defeat to defeat. So there are sometimes, it's tempting to feel that something has fundamentally changed. How can a government continue when it can't govern? And yet, I don't think it has fundamentally changed. I mean, at a certain point, again, we haven't quite reached that point yet where it can't govern. And I think people have slightly got ahead of themselves as feeling there's been this talk this week that the amendment that went down by two votes last night was thought to be the amendment where Parliament, the legislature, takes control from the executive. You can't do that in the British system. The only people who can govern are the government. The only people, not just who can negotiate, but who can actually perform the functions of government. Parliament can't take control of that. Were Parliament to take control, what that means is the government must fall, and you would need a new government. So, and the basic question of British politics always still has to be, what do you want? You want a second referendum? You want Norway plus? You want this? You want that? You have to construct the government that could deliver it. And that government would have to have the confidence of the Commons. And it's really, really hard to get to that point with any of them. So it's this double thing going on. A lot of conventional wisdom has been overturned about what you can get away with. But the deep underlying structure of British politics has not, I think, changed. And it may be that what we discover as we come to the real choices next week, if Theresa May cannot finally pull the rabbit out of the hat, is that her government will fall. I mean, that's my instinct.
I think that one of the things that has come out of it is in particular relation to one thing that's got much broader significance, I think, in terms of the constitutional questions that David's talking about, and that is what the consequences of changing the Fixed Term Parliament Act were. Because what that has essentially meant is that it's just not possible in the same way for a government to basically survive in difficult circumstances by using confidence votes and tying them to particular pieces of legislation. And this was the method actually by which in the end John Major got the Maastricht Treaty through the House of Commons, which was incredibly difficult for him to achieve, and the ratification of that treaty was incredibly difficult to achieve.
And just to clarify for American listeners who might not be familiar with the Fixed Term Parliament Act, does that set elections at every 5 years or something like that and prevent governments from falling again and again?
Yeah, it doesn't completely ensure that parliaments will last for the fixed term, as was demonstrated when Theresa May had support from the Labour Party to dissolve the last parliament and bring about a general election. But it does make this method of using confidence votes in order to provide discipline for the party in government significantly more difficult, if not near impossible, than was previously the case. Now, that piece of legislation was introduced by the coalition government because it was thought about in terms of maintaining the coalition between the Conservatives and the Liberal Democrats and effectively buying the Conservatives into it for the length of the Parliament. Nobody thought about it in terms of like what the consequences were for confidence votes and trying to have a minority government that didn't actually have a coalition partner and a coalition agreement, let alone trying to deal with something like Brexit in relation to it. And I think what you can see looking back over the last 20, 30 years even of British politics, certainly since the late 90s, so 20 years, is that we've had a series of constitutional changes, including devolution for Scotland and Wales, that turn out to have profound consequences that aren't really thought through. And that what happens in the way the British constitution works is you change a small part of it and actually you cause a whole set of disruption all the way around it. You can't kind of like fiddle around in an ad hoc way without actually bringing about pretty significant change. And there's just one more thing I would say that I've reflected upon, and that is in some sense how odd then the period in British politics is between, like, let's say the 1920s after Ireland's independence and the late 1960s and the early 1970s when you start to get the nationalist question in Scotland back again. It seems actually that that's just an aberration, and that actually questions about the territorial formation of the United Kingdom as a multinational state is just a permanent part most of the time of British politics.
And if I just pick up on one thing about the Fixed Term Parliament Act, to put it in slightly too simplistic terms, the difference used to be American presidents don't resign, but they don't get to choose when they fight elections. The trade-off in the British case was prime ministers had this weakness, which is, from one day to the next, they never knew when they might be forced out of office because they've lost the confidence of the House of Commons. But they had this incredible weapon in their arsenal, which is they could choose the timing of the election. It was a huge feature of British politics. When would the Prime Minister play the Trump card? Mm-hmm. And what we've now got is this period where it seems that British Prime Ministers don't resign. Theresa May has not resigned. But they also have lost that weapon to choose when you call an election, because her position would have been enormously strengthened in some ways if she could have threatened her MPs with an election, but it would also have been weakened because it would be under the system where to lose these votes would have precipitated a resignation. And so the dynamic has fundamentally changed.
To ask a somewhat complicated question rather simplistically, would this process have been any easier if Britain only had two parties?
I don't think it's possible that Britain can have two parties as a multinational state. I think that's one of the issues. You certainly can't have normal Labour Conservative Party politics in Northern Ireland. I mean, the parties don't stand. It effectively has its own party system. Northern Ireland is central to the difficulties of Brexit. So I don't think that there's any way you can get past this particular aspect of the predicament.
And yet there is a way of putting your question in reverse, which is that part of the difficulty with this is that it's having to be funneled through these two parties primarily, which are so divided. And we're in this odd position. Okay, we've seen, again, since we spoke last time, there's been a big development in British politics in that a group of MPs from both parties, primarily from Labour, have left to set up this new independent grouping. And there's the possibility of a shifting here. And that's changed some of the polling. It depends. in the recent polling, if you mention this independent group, significant numbers of people say they will vote for them. But unless you actually mention them, no one's aware that they exist. And so in those polls, the electorate still divides. Roughly 80% of voters are still either Labour or Conservative voters. And yet there was this other extraordinary poll a few weeks ago where people, I think it was 69% of people, said they didn't think either of the two main parties represented them. So you got 80% of people voting for one of the two main parties, 69% of whom don't feel these parties represent them. It's funneling this extraordinarily complex political process, but also set of divisions, through a first-past-the-post two-party system, which is also producing some of the complications.
I know both of you also look at American politics and our structures and the way our government has functioned, not just over the past 3 years, but over the past decade. Obviously, our governmental structures, the way our democracies were designed, are pretty different. But do you see like underlying root similarities in the deadlock in both of our governmental systems, or do they come from completely different places?
I think there's some similarities in terms of what's going on in the Democratic Party at the moment to what's been going on in the Labour Party, in the sense of, for the first time in a significant period of time, having a substantial challenge from the left. And obviously, in the case of the Labour Party, the left does now have control of the party, and that's not quite the case in the case of the Democrats. I think the position of Trump in relation to the Republican Party doesn't really have a parallel here, because we haven't had somebody who's come from completely outside, who could in principle actually have been at some point in the other political party, coming and taking the de facto leadership of that political party. So I think at that point the comparison breaks down.
And also, so we don't have those kind of staging posts in the drama that you do around the budget or the wall or whatever, the things that are leading to the gridlock or the shutdown. Brexit is not like those things, not least because it's so dependent on a whole series of external actors, other governments, it's a negotiation and so on. And so it doesn't have the rhythm, what feels like the rhythm of these, some of them symbolic and some of them real confrontations around a series of issues that keep coming back, particularly the budget. British politics, it in some ways it's more fluid than that, but in other ways I think there are clearly overlaps. And what lies behind it all, or part of what lies behind it all, which is that these parties do not reflect some of the fundamental divides in the societies that they represent, that those divides, particularly the generational divides and the educational divides, they cut across the parties. And a big part of the struggle in these binary systems, where there are these huge social divisions that are also in some sense binary, college-educated versus non-college-educated, you know, the over 50s versus the under 40s, leaving the people in their 40s somewhere in between, they just don't map onto each other. And I think it's not surprising that you get, if not gridlock, a kind of clogging up of the system, because these systems are not, I mean, they are adaptable in the sense that every now and then one order is just replaced by another one, but they're not fundamentally adaptable when it comes to reflecting social divisions that don't fit.
Yeah, I think you could look at it the other way, though. You could say that actually that there's more manifestation of the divisions within British society and American society and British and American politics than there is in some of the European countries. And you've got more of a possibility of generational renewal, both within the Labour Party and the Democratic Party, than you can see, I think, in some of the centre-left parties in the European cases.
All right. Well, as always, this has been a really fascinating and illuminating conversation for me. As we wrap up here,
don't ask us to predict. Do not ask us to predict.
You were able to predict what I was going to ask.
Okay, there we go. That's my prediction.
So, what does it seem like the likeliest scenario is? We deal in probabilities here. We're not going to ask you to look into a crystal ball and tell us what exactly is going to happen. I mean, my sense from our conversation is that you think the likeliest scenario is that May's agreement will eventually pass because of a forced choice. Am I wrong on that?
No, I mean, I've thought for, you know, some time since, I'm not really sure when, since you got the agreement, that the balance of probabilities that it would eventually pass, I wouldn't necessarily put that probability above 50%. I just think it's still more likely than any of the other possibilities. And I think that in the last 24 hours, that Theresa May's position has significantly improved.
I agree with Helen. I also put it around, I know it doesn't sound a very helpful answer, around 50-50, but that's higher than it has been for a while. Absolutely, if you have to name an outcome, the likeliest outcome is Theresa May's deal passing. It's not necessarily the likeliest outcome if the alternative is just an alternative. I think something may still have to give. I think the question of how long she's willing to keep going is the one thing that we haven't had clarity from her on, and there may be movement on that. It's very hard to see her continuing for much longer, not least because her cabinet has sort of broken around her. But she hasn't said anything about that. And she's a very stubborn person, and she's a very determined person. She also has a mission. And her mission, she has two missions. One is to deliver Brexit, but the other is to kind of make up for the mistake of the 2017 election. And I think she's going to be reluctant to leave office until she feels that she's done something beyond Brexit that signals that she was a decent prime minister. There's also word that she wants to be in office longer than Gordon Brown was. And apparently politicians do think in these terms. But I mean, it's likelier than it was a week ago that her deal will pass. The only other thing I'll say is the thing I could not predict is if it does not pass next Tuesday, what would happen? I think if it does not pass next Tuesday, literally or almost literally, anything is possible.
I would say on the Theresa May thing, I think if you were casting this as a film and you were getting to the end of the story, that the most inevitable end of the story, so to speak, the one that would make the most storytelling sense, would be that the act gets through and she lays down her sacrifice of herself.
That would be if it was a sports movie, but it's not. It's a politics movie.
And of course, listeners to this podcast know that we at 538 are, if only for selfish journalistic purposes, always in favor of chaos. So either way, it turns out to be a cinematic experience, or it turns into utter chaos, which I guess for journalists is kind of an interesting story to tell either way, kind of laying out my media bias there.
But there is evidence I was reading today. So some of the journalists are starting to have serious sort of mental health issues around this too. I think when you're right at the heart of it, even some of the journalists are begging for it to be over. That's a sign of how bad things have got.
I mean, I know that feeling from elections. By the end, you're like, I just want this to be over. But anyway, let's leave it there for today. Thank you so much, Helen Thompson.
Thank you. Thank you, Galen. Good to talk.
And thank you, David Runciman.
Thanks. I'm sure well, I don't know if you'll invite us back, but I'm sure there's more to talk about in the future.
Of course, I'm sure there will be. David and Helen are professors at the University of Cambridge and host the Talking Politics podcast. A reminder that we have a few tickets left for our live show in New York City on March 20th. You can go to 538.com/live to check that out. My name is Galen Druk. Tony Chow actually isn't in the control room. We're recording this bright and early in the morning to accommodate UK time. But anyway, you can get in touch by emailing us at podcasts@538.com. You can also, of course, tweet at us with any questions or comments. If you're a fan of the show, leave us a rating or a review in the Apple Podcast Store, or just tell someone about the show. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you soon.